I'm Gavin Terry, as I was introduced. In terms of questions, I'm very happy if I'm explaining a particular point at a given time. I'm happy if you want to ask a question, put up your hand, break in. If you have questions which don't relate to the material at hand, something that I might be addressing in the future, there'll be plenty of time for questions. I'll be running the BOF letter on. If you have any specific queries about your own experiences with Postgres and so on, it's probably best to see me after the talk or when we have some time at the end of the talk, just so we can keep the pace moving. I'm a software engineer. I spend most of my time working in industries with Postgres deployments, so Postgres support, programming, and some customization, tagging the source, etc. Other times, I'm actually contributing to Postgres itself. So without further ado, Postgres has a very long and rich history in academia. It was originally conceived at Berkeley University, whose gates I've got an image of just there. Believe it or not, it was spawned from a project called Ingres. Ingres was originally written, people began writing Ingres in 1973, so it's one of the oldest open source projects available. Postgres work began specifically in 1977 with the work of Professor Stonebreaker and Eugene Wong. Stonebreaker was the real guiding light of Postgres at the time, or it was called PostQL back then because they were looking for an alternative to the relational model. Believe it or not, they didn't think there was any future in the relational model, but everyone safe. Stonebreaker left Berkeley University to set up a company to actually sell Ingres, came back to Postgres, worked on it from 86 to 92, then left to set up Informix Corporation, of which I believe he was the CEO or chairman. And when he left, Postgres was handed over to the students and remained a student project. By about 1995, Jolly Chan and Andrew Yu, of which I managed to obtain a picture, added SQL support. Postgres again was an SQL database. It wasn't trying to go past them as a Stonebreaker was trying to imply by calling it PostQL. In 1996, the students working on the project saw that it was a viable project and that it was one of only a very small number of open source, freely available relational databases. They saw the potential of the project and appealed to the open source community, which was now getting a lot of momentum because of Linux, BSD, and so on, and asked for people to contribute on a full-time or part-time basis to the code itself. This appeal was taken up by a number of people who looked at the code, tightened it out, got rid of all the Lisp code that was in there. Of course, it was developed at university, so it had to have a large amount of Lisp involved. It was originally completely written in Lisp, but they pulled out all the Lisp, replaced it with C, a YAC parser, that had been written by Jolly Chan, and then began really looking at bugs, solving problems, actually using it in real-world environments. Bruce Momkin, who is at the bottom right-hand side here, kneeling down, was working at a legal firm at the time, and he migrated the whole database architecture onto Postgres. So we were getting real mission-critical usage out of Postgres, even at this very early time. And so the people working on it, including Bruce, began applying patches that have been sitting in patch queues for years, really just adding structure, managing the project as a proper software development project, not an academic project. Now we have a core team. Obviously, this is a photo. Unfortunately, it's a little out of date now. In the top is Thomas Lockhart. Thomas is now retired from the project. Jan, who is very active now, he's just totally rewritten our buffer management system. Tom Lane, who is really the the core member of core, if you will. He's the guy who does the real nitty-gritty. He spends the most time looking at people's patches. He understands how all the most complex parts of the code work. Mark lives in Nova Scotia and runs a commercial company supporting Postgres. He also provides all the location for the project servers free of charge, which accounts to a large amount of money. So he really provides an excellent service to the project in that respect. Vadim, who has now, I believe, left the project and funded it to Bruce, is a new core member now called Josh Burkus, who lives in San Francisco. And Josh is trying to head up an advocacy run for Postgres. As I said, these people came in, focused on cleaning out the code, restructuring it, turning it into a proper open source project. Naturally enough, this led to an excellent increase in reliability and stability, and therefore attracted new users, more development, and the project snowballed from there. Subsequently, the project was renamed PostgreSQL to just really tie together all those competing aspects of Postgres' history, the ingress aspect, the fact that it was SQL, the post aspect, even though it's not actually post, as in after SQL, and the copyright now is transferred to the Postgres Global Development Group, although some parts are still owned by Berkeley and so on. But it is a mixed project. It's released under a Berkeley license, and the structure of the project itself really reflects that Berkeley license. So I've got a list of lines of code over the last few years which have been contributed to Postgres. You can see about back in 1996, not between 1994 and 1996, when the code was pushed out into the open source community, it was quite small, but by the end of 1996, they'd stripped out a lot of code, which was superfluous, buggy, and so on, probably a lot of list. By 1997, they increased the code base again, but greatly increased stability, so that was a lot of rewriting. Moving forward to today, or recent history, in 2000 we can see it's grown to 380 odd thousand lines of code. 7.1 was 410, 7.2 back down, which is important because there's been a lot of restructuring of code. Pulling out superfluous code is always important. 7.3 grew again, and 7.4 was another 50,000 lines of code. So this constant feature addition, constant reworking of Postgres, running on a 6 to 12 month major release cycle with minor releases every couple of months within that cycle. Subsequently, we now have very good documentation, excellent mailing list support, just like you would expect from most high-profile open source projects. We're seeing commercial support from PostgreSQL Inc., which is the company that Mark, the core member, runs, from Red Hat, from a company called Command Prompt, who's written a few books for O'Reilly, from SRA, which is a huge Japanese software development company with 1,800 programmers, and from consultants such as myself worldwide. We're getting news of installations of greater than a terabyte, which is a real milestone for people in the database industry. It's used by the .org and .info registries. Red Sheriff claimed the other day that they have a 32 terabyte PostgreSQL database processing 10 billion transactions a month, which is big by open source standards. Extensive Australian government use. I know personally Bureau of Meteorology and educate.au, which is an internal education portal which was brought over from Oracle from memory. And interestingly, Postgres is the third database in the database stakes within Japan behind Oracle and MSSQL. So it's certainly made a lot of ground over the last couple of years. But enough of all that sort of stuff. You're already sold on Postgres, I hope, anyway. Let's have a look at some interesting and more advanced features which were added in 7.4, which was released in about November of last year. One interesting thing that was added was the information schema. A schema in a database, if you're not familiar, is a programmatic construct to allow namespace definitions. If you have a look at the very, very simple diagram which I've put together. I'm very bad with graphics, but anyway, it's the fact that this is in HTML. Databases contain schemas. It can contain one to effectively infinity schemas. Within schemas are where database objects that you'd be familiar with are stored, relations or tables, as they're widely known. Sequences, indexes, views, all those things that you will actually use within your applications are stored within the schema so that different tables can be differentiated from one another in different schemas so that you don't get namespace conflicts. One schema in Postgres and in other ANSI databases is the information_schema. That's literally the name of it. And that schema contains a set of views which effectively describe what the database the application is connected to looks like. So it has things such as the defined length of strings, the possible length of table names, all the SQL features according to the ANSI SQL numbers and so on. Naturally, this is very important if you want to make a highly portable application. Consider a software house which needs to support five different SQL, semi-SQL compliant databases, but they don't want to define modules for each aspect of the application to suit Postgres, Oracle, DB2, and so on. They're able to learn, or should be able to learn from the SQL schema enough information that they don't need to know what database they're interacting with specifically. I've just detailed a few of the interesting views which you can make use of more or less straight away to learn things about your database with your Postgres applications. The first view is information_schema. information_system_catalog_name, which is actually just the current database name. But prior to adding this, it was actually, there was only a non-portable way of doing it. You literally had to look in a catalog called pg_database, which is, first of all, very unportable, and second of all, may change in the future. The SQL schema is guaranteed not to change, at least for quite some time. I don't think there's any changes from SQL 99 to SQL 2003, which is the new ANSI standard. And if there are, there are only enhancements. So none of the old constructs have been removed. The next interesting view within information schema is information_schema.columns. This lists all the columns in the current database that you're connected to that the user who queries that view has access to. In that way, you can build up a complete hierarchical representation of the database. Information_schema.routines lists all the functions, like that is stored procedures used to define functions and system functions which are present in the database and which the user has the ability to call. Information_schema.schemata lists all the schemas within the current database which the user has access to. And they've been defined in this way so that a user can interact with a database in a totally transparent manner. So that if a database has been modified in some way, an application that, say, a proprietary application, does not need to be aware of that modification because those modifications are occurring within another schema in the database. The user of that application will only see the data within the schemas they're allowed to access. SQL underscore features lists with the ANSI SQL code, which is a reasonably arbitrary number, numeric code. It lists all the features that are supported so that an application can connect and dynamically reprogram itself to use SQL, which it knows the database is compliant to. Obviously, many databases support many different levels of SQL compliance, so that if a database, however, meets a certain extent of SQL compliance, the application itself can determine what it will send as a query based on that rather than hard coding, so that the application itself can grow as new releases of the database are provided. SQL underscore slicing gives information as to the length of data types and so on within the database. And SQL underscore schema tables lists all the tables in the database which the user has access to and their relevant schemas. Are there any aspects of that which need more explaining? Okay, I'll go on. I mentioned Tom Lane before. Tom loves taking on projects that no one else wants to touch, including a complete rewrite of the front-end and back-end protocol for 7.4. He added to this SQL-compliant error codes so that when an error is generated in the back-end, an SQL-compliant error code, an SQL-compliant error message are sent to the client so that instead of having to parse messages, a client can simply parse an SQL error code, which is the handling of which has been coded into the application because it's standard. It also provides status information about the actual state of the backend, so you can know pretty much exactly what the backend is doing at any given moment, including whether or not it's in a transaction and what stage of parsing and executing a query the backend is up to. It has faster startup because we're using now fewer startup packets. We have better binary transfer, including compression on the fly. Prepared statements outside of SQL, which I'll be talking about a little bit more later on. But importantly, the old protocol is still supported so that people with statically linked clients or with old libraries that they need to continue to use but want to use 7.4 still have complete access to it with no problems encountered so far. Let's have a bit of a look then at, fewer packets mean less network traffic. Are there any other questions about the Y protocol? Let's have a look at how error handling and error reporting now works in Postgres. There was a twofold modification to error handling and error reporting. The first and significant one was that we have error messages which are now consistently written. Even though that sounds trivial, they're written with a consistent language in coded in the back end in correct English. Even though that sounds strange, again, it's important to be able to have error messages which you can present to a user. There aren't embedded new lines, for example, and punctuation flows as you would expect from a professional enterprise application. The other aspect to it is that we have much more information out of errors. First of all, we have an SQL error code, which I talked about before. And secondly, we have three levels of information relating to any given error. The first bit of information is a simple statement as to what went wrong, such as no such relation or no such table. The second level of error message is an optional level, but when supported, it will give you information about how to perhaps rectify that. And the third level, which has been termed verbose for obvious reasons, gives extended information, including sometimes a stack trace back, the function where the error occurred, the line offset, and so on. These can be, this level of verbosity can be set within libpq, and I believe within some of the languages supporting Postgres. Just this morning I checked whether or not PHP supports it, but PHP hasn't yet moved to it, so people are still probably trying or getting to terms, getting around to supporting this, but certainly it makes coding an application much, much simpler to have proper error codes. I've just got an example of what the three different levels of verbosity mean. If you look on line one, we set the verbosity, this is within PSQL, so PSQL applies straight into libpq and calls the function pq set error verbosity that I've detailed above. We generated an error on line two. The error, of course, is that there is no operator at symbol hash, so we generate a short or terse message, which just says that the operator does not exist, and gives detail about what the backend has tried to do. That is, it's tried to parse an integer and find an operator, but that operator doesn't exist. We change the verbosity to default, and we see that on supplementary to the error on line 3, we also receive on line 7 a hint as to how to rectify the problem. It says no operator matches and so on. Finally, on line 12, when we're set on line 8, the verbosity to verbose, we actually get the location of the error, and that location is line 700 and so on. So it gives people debugging applications and trying to solve complex problems very useful and detailed information about how to solve that problem. Are there any questions about the new error handling framework? The other aspect to this is that, first of all, the C language functions PQ error message and PQ result error message are still supported and still behave in the same way as before. But a new function, PQ result error field, has been developed so that users can actually access every bit of status and error information which is actually sent back from the server. That function takes two arguments. First of all, for those familiar with the library, the result handle or the resource handle. And the second argument is the field that you're actually interested in from the error report itself. If you pass S, obviously cast to an integer, if you pass S to this, you get a syslog-like identifier. Error, fatal, panic, and so on. C gives you the SQL state code. This is the SQL unsigned compliant error code, which is a five-digit alphanumeric code. M gives the human readable message. D was the detailed message we saw before. Hint is an optional hint as to how to fix it. P is an optional character offset to the problem so that your application could design a cursor to point to the exact SQL area in SQL where the error occurred. It's also white character aware. Unfortunately, it doesn't support all areas, only general legacy errors basically. Where gives an optional stack traceback in the case of some procedural languages. F gives the file where the error occurred, L the line, R the routine. Going hand in hand with these new error message and error reporting changes, we have three new what are called GUC variables, or configuration variables essentially. These can be configured within PostgreSQL.conf, and the three variables are log underscore mean underscore messages. This variable, when you set it to a PostgreSQL, syslog identifier, will log only though that level of severity and above. So if you put in fatal, it would only log fatal messages. You put in debug, it would log debug and everything after debug. Client admin messages is exactly the same, except it defines the level of verbosity within logging that the client received. Log min duration statement was an interesting modification by Chris Kingsline, who was at Perth last year. And this allows you to set in milliseconds a threshold at which a query, the actual text of a query, will be logged to the database itself. So that if you're trying to debug a complex application and you can't find out which query is really killing your backend in terms of performance, you can actually have those queries logged if they take more than, say, 5 seconds to run, 1 second, 10 seconds, 3 minutes, whatever you like. We also now have holdable cursors. A cursor, for those who aren't familiar with it, the concept, is a means by which you can select a result set and scroll through at your leisure, essentially, not in real time, at your leisure through the result set, with the result set remaining on the server side. The reason why such a feature is important is that, for example, if you have a very small terminal going through a very large SAS report, which might be a couple of 100 megabytes in size, you wouldn't want to transfer that entire block of data to the client in one hit. So Postgres is able to manage that using cursors. It's a common SQL feature. The problem that we had with this was that cursors could only be used inside transactions. And the reason why they could only be used inside transactions was that we couldn't handle the situation where another writer to the table, such as PG class, which is what we're declaring the cursor on in the example, another writer to that would essentially corrupt the cursor by adding more data which had not been present when the cursor was opened. So we had a concurrency issue. That issue is solved inside transactions, because that's what transactions do. Neil Conway, who is probably one of the most exciting people to come and work on Postgres in the last couple of years, decided to tackle the problem. Neil's about 18 and a half, and he works in, he goes to university, and he's now a core developer. This guy is just unbelievable, he blows me away. But anyway, so he just sort of picks, of all things, concurrency problems in the back end to fix. So now you can add, in an SQL compliant fashion, because this is SQL 99, a perimeter to declare cursor, such as the one in line 2 or line 3 of the example. You'd add withhold to that before the for statement, just here. You just add withhold there, and that cursor could exist outside of a transaction. What that means is that within that transaction, you could open the cursor, then commit and continue to use the cursor. It means that you could have opened the cursor up here, used inside of a transaction, operate inside the transaction, then roll back and have your changes undone, and then continue to use the cursor, so that the cursors can be present across transactions, outside of transactions, and so on. Very important for migration purposes with databases that don't support transaction blocks. Any questions about the withhold cursors? This unfortunately, I know exactly what you mean. This unfortunately is what I've been banging my head against, because after Neil finished that, I was working on a project for a company which wanted the complete feature of SQL 99 cursors, and that feature is what's termed updatable and insertable into cursors. Updatable, insertable, deletable cursors allow you to specify, based on the position of the cursor, an update to the table that the cursor is based on. So, say we have a cursor foo. We have a cursor foo on a table bar. We scroll down 5 records. And say, let's take the example of this is a sales report. We're just doing the end of day processing, and the manager is ticking off whether or not some transactions are correct or not. Gets to the 5th record, finds out that the transaction is invalid for whatever reason, human error. He now wants to update that to say that it's invalid. And there's a field within bar called valid. He wants to set that field to be false. In the current implementation of Postgres in 7.4, and in many other databases, unfortunately, you would actually have to have some unique identifier, which you would probably have anyway, on bar, and update that table using a usual update, say, an update bar set valid equals false, where ID equals something or other. This is a problem, however, when you have many to one kind of tables. So taking the example of that transaction log, you might just have a product ID and a purchase time and this active valid field. There might be many, many purchases of that particular product ID. So how do you update it? Well, you would have to have some unique construct, but using an SQL compliant term, which is where current, you would actually be able to update or delete that cursor, delete that record based on the position of the cursor. This is actually leading somewhere. I was working on this and discovered what Neil had actually used, and he's actually used the temporary storage framework for sorting. How he got it in, I don't know. But it worked for that particular application. It worked for my application, but it didn't work for the core developers. Which means that has to be rewritten. So to answer your question, it's actually stored on disk in a temporary file, but that actually meets the semantics of cursors, which are different to usable transactions. Reason being, unlike transactions, cursors cannot be updated based on concurrent writes, which incorrectly identified. So we take it external to the database, put it in a file, or we actually store it in memory if it's sufficiently small, and that's completely separate to the whole multi-version concurrent system, which is how it's defined. But that will get a rear working to 7.5, 7.6. It actually means that they're very fast, because they mostly just sit in memory and don't have to do anything with transactions. Were there any other questions about that? Joe Conway, no relation to Neil, but equally enthusiastic, added SQL 99 compliant arrays. How many people actually use arrays in pre-7.4 Postgres? A few people, and that's completely understandable because they're very painful. 7.4, however, has been tightened up. It has much better arrays, and it has SQL 99 compliant array. In fact, it has a lot of features of SQL 2000X. Pre-7.4, array handling would look something like that. If you wanted to create an array in a table that had two elements, you would just say it's an integer, you would create into, just like in C. If you wanted to insert data, you would insert it just like you would create a static array in C. That's all the same. However, if you wanted to iterate through that array in order to find one element, you would actually have to literally iterate out in SQL the check for each field. And that's okay for two fields, but if you have a 300-dimensional array, that's pretty problematic. Joe added support for arrays to be treated just like subqueries. And that means that the subquery functions any, all, and sum support arrays and actually turn them into subqueries. So that top level left hand side elements can actually be compared to and operated on by right-hand side elements, such as the example here, where instead of literally iterating through each dimension in the pre-7.4 example, we just use the keyword any, and that takes care of the iteration for us. Joe's also added much better array typing. The people who use 7.3 arrays will be very excited about this better array typing. It makes constructing arrays within SQL much, much simpler. So there is an array keyword, and in order to construct an array on the fly, we would just run this simple example. And there we have a two-element, one-dimension array. Importantly, he's also provided mechanisms to make this operate with all our other operators, so that when you create two arrays, both with two elements, element 1 and 2, 3 and 4, using the double pipe or concatenate operator, Postgres is now able to realize that you want to join those two arrays together, and it presents to you the final joined array. How Joe did this was by creating two concepts within Postgres, which we previously lacked, but which SQL 99 and SQL 2003 required, and they were polymorphic types. Polymorphic types describe, it's like a pseudo type. It's like void star or any in Corba and so on. And so we have two polymorphic types which contain effectively any data. Any array, we can receive any array data type. So if the array is typed as a text array, integer array, irrespective of what it is, any array can receive that data. Any element can actually receive any data type, including arrays. This means that we can do lots of really, really funky stuff with arrays. such as less than and greater than, as I've shown just a few examples here. First one there, the mechanism for testing the arrays is a left to right hand comparison of elements. So it doesn't matter how large, how many elements an array has, if the left hand to right hand side comparison is true for an array with just one or two elements, then it will succeed, it will be greater than it. Importantly, and for obvious reasons, you can't compare a single dimension array with a multi-dimensional array because the semantics are undefined. Was there a question up there? Yes. It compares it left-hand side to right-hand side. So it goes, take element one from both arrays. Is one less than three? Yes. No, it will stop at the length of the first array. So the semantics at first don't make sense, but unfortunately this is how it's defined in SQL. The comparison ends at the end of the shortest array. So those are the semantics, but again, it allows you to take arrays apparently of different types, because one has many, many elements, what has been defined as having 64 single dimension elements, one which has two, and to compare those along the same criteria. And the greater than operator behaves in the same way. We also have an equal to operator, so that you can see if two arrays are equivalent, a not equal to operator. We also have, as I said above, the concatenation operator, the double pipe. Were there any more questions just about that array typing and the array operators? There are no operators, and there is no function. Using the function I'm not about to detail, I think that you could splice arrays, but there is no array splice function. Knowing Joe, he's actually probably working on it, but there is currently no, to my knowledge, array splice function outside of CDS head. Moving on to those functions then, Joe added a number of functions to simplify array handling and to treat arrays just like you would treat them within a programming language or a higher level programming language. So the first function, array append, simply pushes an element onto an array. You'll notice that I've specified the arguments in terms of any array and any element. The first argument, any array, can be your array data type where your array is at the moment, so it might be something like array 1, 2, so a 2 element array, you can pass that as the argument. Any element is the data which you want to append, and that data will be cast to the data type of the array passed in the first argument. Array prepend is simply the opposite, it prepends that data to the beginning of the list. Array cat is the same as the double pipe. It concatenates argument 1 to argument 2. Array lower gives the lower bound or the smallest value element within the given array as argument 1, within the dimension passed as the second argument. So if you had a one-dimensional array, which looked something like this. You would pass, you would call array lower, underscore lower, give it the array, pass, if it was given, sorry, that it's a single dimension array, you would pass 1, because it's a one dimensional array, and it would return 1 as being the lower bound, since it's the smallest element within that array. Likewise, array upper will give you 3, because it's the upper bound of the array. This allows you, of course, to predict the outcome of comparisons and so on, if that's important within your application. Is there a question? It depends what object, what you're talking about in terms of an object. Say a table or something. Arrays can't be, no, arrays can't store tables, but what it, yes, it can store complex structures, either user-defined structures, and it may, off the top of my head, the other work that Joe worked on, I'm going to talk about in a sec, in passing is set returning function, so you can actually return as an object, a complete row of a table. So it's possible that that might be able to be stored, but that one's got, I can't remember if it's possible. It seems like it should be. Well, it's quite simple. It just has to be a comparison function. So the concept of lower and upper is simply less than and greater than. So if there is a function coded into the system which has a less than and greater than comparison, which is necessary for B-tree indexing anyway, you will be able to do that. So for example, if it was text, you would use the text comparison strings. Integer, integer comparison. Numeric data types, floating points, you would use those, but it would be decidedly difficult to compare aspects, rows of tables and so on. So I don't think it's available, but you could do some pretty cool stuff with it, I think. Were there any other questions about array handling just at this point? Okay, I'll go on. Array dims simply returns the number of dimensions that the array has. Array to string actually converts an array into a text string and delimits the array. So when I gave it this representation, that's the PostgreSQL representation, but say for the convenience of your application, you needed semicolons, pipes, whatever you wanted, you could pass that as a string of effectively any length. And string to array allows you to parse in array or structured data which can be parsed into an array using whatever delimiter you decide. There is also now index support for arrays, but unfortunately you can't create an index on a single dimension. So say you had some structured data within your data arrays, and one column, it was a data mining app, and one column or one element of an array, say the second element, required information which you regularly queried. At this point in time, we do not support indexing on just the second element. We have to support it on the whole array. Ah, yes, sorry, yes, I understand what you mean now. I see no reason why we wouldn't, because what a functional index is an index where you create the index on the return of a function. another useful aspect of Postgres, and it would work because the actual typing and indexing system doesn't know anything about, that doesn't know much about the argument passed into the function. It's mostly interested in the return type, but it's only slightly interested in the argument passed, because that gets put into the planner so that it can work out where it's being selected index in that particular operation. So yes, it will be able to create indexes as that. So you could theoretically, as I think you've identified, use some of these functions to pull out one element of an array and therefore create that. Yes, but they all elements of the array have to be cast to a particular type. But because many of the types can be easily cast to one another, I mean, one can imagine quite simply how to cast a floating point number to a text, for example, or an integer into a floating point and so on, they will be cast to the type. Not that this affects your application, because SQL effectively looks like a typeless system, but they will be cast to the type which all elements match. And if there is no casting available, say you create a data type which stores complex numbers, but there's no ability to cast that to a textual representation, and you're putting it in a text array, you'll get an error saying that there's no, it cannot run a cast for that data type. So you can actually create the cast to solve that problem, but no, it won't support it out of the box. But with all the basic types supported by Postgres, which can be logically converted from one to the other, you can do so. They're totally different, but I think your question is more of a conceptual one. I'll try to address it quickly. Arrays and foreign keys define the structure of your data. If you wanted to use an array within a given table, you might be using it in order to summarize and accumulate data within a single column to simplify a many-to-one relationship. This is basic set theory. If you have a foreign key or an implicit key-based many-to-many relationship, you would do that because you need the information to be available at all times and up to date, whereas your array-based table might simply be a summary generated every hour for the point of reporting. That's obviously not all uses for arrays, but they are distinctly different concepts. It's just that in some situations, arrays can condense a meaning to one relationship into a linear representation, which can be passed by your application back into many to one, and therefore simplify your SQL. So I haven't exactly answered your question. If you want to look at it further, we can talk about it later on in the talk. Were there any further questions about array handling specific to these functions and the typing system and so on? Okay. Not to be outdone by Joe Conway, Neil also decided to add statement level triggers. How a trigger works is, whenever a given SQL event using what's called the data modification language, DML, DML queries are queries which either update, insert, or delete from the table. So whenever a DML event takes place, a Postgres checks whether or not there is a trigger. A trigger, for those who aren't familiar with it, is a piece of code, a computational construct, which can be executed when that update, delete, insert takes place. Prior to 7.4, we only supported row-level triggers. I'll be looking at some specific trigger examples later on, but say you had a database which had staff involved, and within that database was a user table with an email address. When you inserted that data in, you wanted to be able to populate a virtual host file which was being read out of Postgres elsewhere. But the application, when it was written, wasn't designed that way. You could create a trigger to look for inserts on your users table, and when an insert took place, it would take all the data from that line and populate the other table or some file on the file system or any number of things. That's how triggers work at a row level. So if you inserted 10 users at once, the trigger would be fired 10 times. If you deleted users, another trigger could be called or fired, as it were, and those users would be deleted from the virtual alias table in our example. Statement level triggers behave differently, irrespective of how many rows are actually affected by the DML query. The trigger is fired, and when I say irrespective, I mean if no rows are affected, updated, inserted, deleted, or if all rows are deleted, updated, inserted, the trigger will only fire once. So this is particularly useful for perhaps auditing applications. So you wanted to watch who was accessing a particular table, but didn't have enough disk, time, inclination, whatever, to actually record what they were doing. You could just simply register that Joe accessed the table at this particular time, because it logs the state in it as opposed to the update of each row. So this is also defined in SQL 92 and 99, which is the other reason why we wanted to have it. People migrating to Postgres and using Postgres as a replacement for SQL compliant databases really required. Are there any questions about statement level triggers? Sorry, I should have said the word modify. I guess semantically it could make sense to have triggers on a select, but no one implements them because it's a real bottleneck. To find 10 on a select, you can't then control the performance of the system. So I'm not aware of any databases which have triggers on select. Also, the trigger is supplied the new data. So what data do you supply? Statement level trigger, what data is supplied? I'm trying to remember. Within a row level trigger, the new and old, if that's relevant, if it's not an insert, is provided. Statement level trigger, you get the same data structure passed in. It would probably be irrelevant. Conceptually, it's irrelevant because you're operating at a statement level, so you're not actually interested in the data per se, but you'll probably find that given the structure, you get the last row that was updated. If it's an after trigger, you can define whether or not the trigger is run before or after. Perhaps you have to prepare the table in some way or something. Yes. Yes, I see your point. I don't know exactly, but I'm quite sure that they're not implemented in that fashion. Mostly because, just like in any large open source project, code bloat is a real problem in Postgres, so that people sending in patches really have to prove the case for the deployment of it. And Tom and I would basically just say, do it with very little treatment. Although your case is valid, even though it is a niche case. But it is an interesting concept. I'll run it by Neil. Are there any other questions about statement level triggers? Okay, we also have a complete rewrite of a contrib module full text indexing application. Unfortunately, this isn't supported in the vanilla distribution of Postgres. It's in contrib, as I said, which means that it requires a little more administration to get set up. But when it's set up, it behaves in a very, very elegant fashion. I don't have time to look at the configuration behavior of it now, but I'll give you a quick overview of the features. First of all, when indexing text, it strips out all irrelevant data, such as punctuation, common words, plurals, and other so-called metadata, which searches would be polluted with if we didn't strip them out. It also supports the configuration of stop words, so that if you were, for example, you had a set of papers all on Linux, you knew that all of them were going to mention the word Linux many times, you wouldn't want to index the word Linux, because you would be forced to use poor choices within the planner, and your queries would be slow every time someone typed in Linux. Whereas your application put special case that and simply return all papers in, you know, chronological order or whatever. It also supports a default English dictionary and user defined dictionaries, so that users can, interested in indexing words from other languages, can supply their own dictionaries and plug those in an arbitrary manner. It also supports AND, OR, and NOT Boolean operators, so that your data can be queried in a sophisticated manner, in the manner that we're used to with search engines such as Google and so on. So here is some sample output, which I've taken from the documentation. A simple query is passed into a function, and we have an OR operator there halfway through, and so we're looking whether or not we can find some text with the word passage or crawl in it. We find 5 results, and we also have a ranking as to its relevance. The ranking algorithm you can read about within the documentation itself. Sorry, was there a problem? Are you able to do it while I continue talking? Thanks. Sorry. Sorry, it's T-Search too. Sorry, yeah, that's the font in. It's T-Search, Tech Search 2, written by a guy in Sweden, I think. It's just a really nice, clean module. There's actually much more to it than a simple query like this. You can get word placement order and so on out of it, but... I would imagine so, but off the top of my head, I can't remember. Sorry, it's all quite well documented. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Within the documentation itself, the manual defines how to simplify queries. Otherwise, the queries can become quite long. You have to do with the joins and so on. So the manual itself creates this shows you how to create this function findDog, which actually points and is hard-coded to query a particular full-text index. So that function actually returns a table, which is the work that Joe worked on, that I referred to before, for the ability to have a function to return an entire result set in 2D, if you will. So that function is a crude hack, so that I didn't bore you to death with 25 lines of SQL. And I would strongly recommend you to follow the example of this. You could also pass the table in as an argument, for example, but this was just a simple example which I gleaned from the documents. In terms of indexing, I wouldn't imagine it requires any special handling. Postgres has excellent natural language and Unicode support, so it's imaginable that it would either work out of the box, or with working in conjunction with some experienced people. I mean, the lead developer doesn't speak English, so he would have, and speaking, I think Swedish doesn't require non-ISO 9 characters, I don't think, but he would have encountered the problem. And Christopher Kingsline as well, who is another worker on another guy working on it, does have a database which uses multiple languages. So I would say that the problem's been addressed. We, as I said before, Postgres is the third largest database in the Japanese market, and that's because it has excellent natural language handling. So the guys are really on top of that, like SRA and Fujitsu and stuff like that. So I would say that it's likely that it is possible. Unfortunately, I'm terrible when it comes to languages other than handling of languages other than English. I feel awful when I go to countries that don't speak English, because does Postgres support this? Well, I don't really know. I don't speak your language. But I'm sure without too much coaxing, or maybe out of the box, if it works. Sorry? It doesn't have, from what I read in the code, any knowledge of concepts such as sentences and paragraphs, but it does record within the index itself, which is a index defined outside of the usual Postgres indexes. It does define word order. So conceivably, you could construct a query, which is a little too complex for the talk I'm giving today, which actually matches words in order. Are there any other questions? First of all, without a bit of tweaking, you couldn't put them in as large objects. You have to put them in as text, because it is just an expected text field, or a text-like field, VHR, whatever. Secondly, I don't know about the performance at that end. Certainly, the performance I've seen against an application which was just a homebrew full-text index, that is, take a bunch of words, strip out common words, run sort over them on the command line, put them in a table, create a B tree, and query it. It was significantly faster than that, because the words themselves aren't being stored as such. We're basically using a bitmap, so that we're saying this word is mentioned here, as opposed to storing the word over and over and over again. So sorry, I don't have any benchmarking information, but certainly Chris Kingsline has quite a large index, because he works for a company that sells dietary information. So he's probably indexed 10,000 odd documents and runs it. One of my clients has 125,000 documents in a homebrew index, and it runs sub-second. So it's faster than that. I mean, it's on reasonably good hardware, but still PC hardware. So it would certainly be faster than that. So you would get very responsive times from this module. Certainly let me know if you were data related. As I said before, it does do per record word order, but I think it's per line, to tell you the truth. So by all means, go and have a look at the documentation tonight. The project, the code, including the contrib module, has been put on the live CD. So go break it. If you want, email me your criticisms, and I'll pass them on to the developers and see what we can do about it. But I mean, it doesn't have all the features of Oracle full text indexing, but it's certainly quite an impressive open source package. Especially since there's no modification to the core source code itself. Yeah. So definitely check it out. If it's not there, just keep going stink. Like, it's really that simple. And if you really want it, say it costs you $3,000 a year, just say $1,000 for the first guy to do it, and someone will do it. That's open source, guys. Seriously, that's how it happens. Actually, there's a funny story, just as a quick aside. A guy said he wanted a diff utility for Postgres. Pretty good idea. Take one live database, another live database, which seem to look like each other, run diff against both of them, and produce a patch to bring, say, database 2 up to date with database 1. Poor man's replication, whatever you want to call it, right? I can't remember what they were using it for. The guy who won it, like, they said, look, we'll give you $1,000 and whatever, right? Like, lots of praise, a couple of pieces. Some guy did it. Anyway, it turned out, I was really excited about it. It turned out, they said they wanted it written in Python. Okay, right, Python, whatever. The guy who did it actually created a CGI script. I was just like, what's with that? Like, how unreasonable is a CGI script? So anyway, if you're going to do it, put some good... anyway. But yeah, so always important, especially in open source, that you're finding exactly what you want. Otherwise, you'll get Cobra integrated into the kernel again. Okay, another interesting feature which I've been talking about with my friends from MySQL down at the bottom here. Vacuum is the bane of the Postgres administrator's life. Is this true? Yes? I'm not seeing enough nods, okay. Because we have a particular type of multi-version concurrency control system, and what I mean by that is you can have parallel data access, which is isolated from one another. You don't see the changes unless you want to, of course. Because we have the database structured in this fashion, unfortunately, we have to store state information on disk alongside the rows of a given table. Is that air conditioning too cold for anyone? Anyway, so we have to store this state information. Conceivably, at some point in time, a tuple or row which is deleted from a table will no longer be accessed to any, will no longer be alive for any transaction which is open at the time. So say you have two transactions. And and they're moving forward in time. Transaction one deletes A. For transaction two at this point in time, A is still alive because its transaction began before A was deleted. If it too wants to be transaction 2 can still see that element D, and it has to see that because it's been guaranteed by SQL 99, the transaction isolation level it's linked. It's been guaranteed that it is isolated from any other transaction in the database. Therefore, the effects of other transactions will not be apparent within the transaction, unless, of course, you want them to be. That is T2. Naturally, if T2 then wants to delete A, it has to wait for the outcome of this transaction in order to do so. That's a different story. However, both transactions at this point commit. D is still hanging around because Postgres says maybe there's some other open transaction which needs to see D. It just so happens that there isn't. But there's no accounting system within the Postgres engine to actually determine whether or not that is the case in real time. And this means we have a SQL level mechanism for detecting these missing, these elements which have been deleted or updated, and to remove them, that is shrink things around, move things around on disk so that you free up space. The problem, of course, with this is if you delete, say, half of a table which has a million rows in it, you commit, everything's fine. Your table still has a million rows. It's just that you can only see half a million. So that every time you go in and query that, you're actually spending two times longer in the storage manager than is actually required in optimal situations. This also happens with updates, because all updates are deletes and inserts. You can begin to see how this can compound into a serious performance degradation. Over the years, users and developers of Postgres were very concerned that without knowledge of the vacuum construct, and for users who are used to, say, Sybase, Interbase, Oracle, whatever, they wouldn't be familiar with that. They just want to use SQL. They wouldn't be used to vacuuming the database, and therefore they would see a continued bloat in their database and perhaps switch back to their previous vendor and so on. In reality, their tables were just beginning to look like the diagram I've got there, where there is bloat data which is completely irrelevant to the actual makeup of the table for all transactions. This problem was partially addressed. There is still a concept of vacuum. It was partially addressed in 7.4 in two ways. First of all, we refine the concept of the free space map. The free space map is an attempt to actually add this accounting with zero cost. The reason we could conceivably using something like RCU or something actually get rid of this whole vacuum problem, but imagine a situation such as the one I described, where there's half a million couple of rows which have been deleted from a table, and the table's a million rows long. Next user comes along, just wants one line out of the query, out of the table, but is faced with the penalty of having to move half a million rows, which might be up to a gigabyte of data, say, all over the disk in order to shrink that relation down, it's not viable to have one transaction or several transactions face that kind of penalty without the user knowing that they're going to, or at least not within the Postgres world, which is why Bastion still exists. However, the free space map is an in-between, a joining of the bridge, you might say, between having user transactions look after themselves and having Bastion handle everything. What the free space map is a multi-version concurrency compliant system of recording parts of blocks on disk which are free and can be written to in the fashion that you can see in the image on the whiteboard. So a transaction goes through, removes some data, frees up a couple of pages which are 8 kilobytes in size, and it tells the free space map that those are now free for the next insert. The insert checks whether or not they are actually free so that we're not overriding and corrupting data, and then fills that in if, you know, things are aligned properly and all that sort of thing. But it's not as much as actually having to physically go through and do a wholesale move of things around on disk so that you reduce something from 1 gigabyte to 0.5 gigabyte in size. Populating the free space map is also done by using Vacuum with no arguments. Vacuum with no arguments is a lockless vacuum so that you don't get the performance degradation and your systems can be online and highly and have their usual level of responsiveness. Vacuum goes through, populates the free space map, knowing that there are tuples which are dead and they can be reused later on. Pardon? Well, the problem is fragmentation. This is an attempt at solving that problem. Sorry, just 1 second. What I think the problem you're addressing is data is not stored contiguously and in the expected order on disk. That's a problem addressed by a function called cluster, which allows you to sort data on disk according to the way that you want. I'm not going to deal with cluster in this tutorial. I actually intended to, but forgot all about it. But at the BOF, after the talk, if there's time for questions, I will detail the usage of cluster to sort things on disk. And yes, it does speed up access for very specific reasons. That's right. Conceptually speaking, it's not a problem because if there's any storage penalty, you should be using an index, which is stored in order. So that's why things aren't stored in order like an ISM style concept. But in reality, it is a problem. Ad hoc queries and so on. We're looking at ways of addressing that problem. But cluster is the wholesale way of locking things, just reading it out in a wholesale fashion and resorting the entire data. I can go into why it's faster later on for you. I think there was a question there. Yeah. Sorry, could you speak a little bit? Yes, there will be lock occasion there, but obviously locks relating to disk can be slower because there's more contention and there's possibility of deadlocks, whereas when you're updating a single hash, the lock contention isn't as bad, but because vacuum effectively is only the only thing updating the free space map in a wholesale fashion, you can have much more on disk contention than you are, you know, with a little bit of IPC. Any other questions about the free space map before I move on to look at the other solution? Okay. Introducing PG Auto Vacuum. PG underscore Auto Vacuum is a daemon to sit in the background and do all your vacuuming for you. This means that vacuuming no longer becomes an administrative task, and in ideal situations, Postgres will just run autonomously. Which is a major selling point over open source databases. How does it do this? PG Auto Vacuum connects to the database, which you will ask it to do so, and actually monitors activity on all the tables you're interested in vacuuming. Postgres is able to keep statistics on table modifications, so the number of inserts, the number of deletes, the number of updates. It stores those and makes them accessible to users, and PG Auto Vacuum monitors those, and once it reaches a user configurable threshold, it issues a vacuum on that relation and then populates the free space map or takes out some nasty exclusive page or the blocks and vacuum things and shrinks relations and so on. But it does this on a step-by-step basis so that in production you shouldn't really be experiencing the bottleneck of the once-a-night vacuum of the large batch table which needs 3 gig of data moved out of it. It's been designed intelligently enough that not only is there a threshold, there's also a scaling factor, so that PG Auto Vacuum will allow it to grow over the threshold. So say for example you were quickly populating and deleting from a very large table and you wanted it to get the data to go in very fast, so you were just sending it in, modifying stuff, but you don't want a vacuum to be contending with you for IO resources. So it'll sit around for another 2,000 row updates or 10,000 depending on how you configure it, and then issue the vacuum. It also has the ability to wait between vacuums, so say in the example, the table was being very intensively modified, it can be made wait for 10 seconds, 3 minutes, 3 hours, whatever you like to pass to the configuration. Unfortunately, one of the problems with this is that, like I said, it requires row-level statistics. For very simple queries such as select one from table which has one row, the penalty to store that statistic compared to parsing it and reading the data out of the Postgres cache or from the file system or something is quite significant. But in real-world use, we've found that using row-level statistics for this particular application is not a significant penalty. But naturally, for production usage, I would strongly recommend setting it up in a test environment and actually looking at the kind of performance penalty you may get from row-level statistics and you may get from PG underscore auto vacuum. The other flaw, shortcoming, is that it can only connect to one instance of Postgres. You can't list a number of servers in your configuration file and have a whole cluster of Postgres databases auto-vacuumed from a single machine. Obviously, a desirable feature for a large deployment, but unfortunately, it's not there yet. So, because it's outside of the native build, it does require a little bit of extra administration, but certainly compared to the problems experienced by having to vacuum at odd times and perhaps forgetting to vacuum and therefore suffering the performance penalty, it's a good trade-off. in theory, you would spawn a new thread, and there would be another configuration file, and it would all be tidy. But at the moment, it's just like, in theory, all contrib stuff. It's just stuff that has been confirmed to work. It's useful. It should ship with the default release, but it's just not up to scratch. The developer hasn't had time to integrate it into the backend. Certainly, integrating something into the Postgres backend is a much more significant task than just connecting a C application with libpq. Given that it's a contrib module, it has a likelihood of being integrated. There is no plan as such to have it integrated. Certainly it was on the to-do list, for example, which many contrib modules wouldn't have been. And it was designed by a guy in India who has a large telco installation, which is why he needed something of this nature for 24-hour autonomous operation. So it has a stronger likelihood than most code from contrib to get into the backend, but there are no explicit plans as far as I know. Any other questions about PG Auto backing? Okay, I'll quickly move on because I want to finish in about 10 minutes, the first part of the talk. So, 5 minutes, sorry. Okay, I'll talk really fast. My cousin's Kenny Callender, by the way, so I can talk pretty fast, you know, reading the horses. Commercial level asynchronous master Slack replication. Sorry about that. I did actually completely rewrite my talk. But anyway, ER Server is this product. It was donated by Mark, who I showed you in the photo at the beginning of the talk, and by his company, PostgreSQL Inc. It has been deployed in large-scale production. It was used by Filius, who run .org and .info. They're now using a different product, a more recent product, and that's because the licensing, the means of licensing Mark has put this under is designed such that all the code which he releases, he sells, that's how he makes a living, but 2 years after its first release, it is released under the Berkeley a public license. So he has a means of funding his work habits and also keeping up with the open source ethos. Unfortunately, it is asynchronous. By that I mean that it doesn't happen in real time. So I'll explain further if anyone needs any information, but basically you have a master, data gets written, it gets logged at the master, and then gets pushed out to a slave within some reasonably short period of time, but not real time. So that in any given situation, if you sent data to the master and then queried the slave, you may not see the data on the slave. Or the Slack, as it were. This is not a problem for some, and in some cases, many applications. Consider an application which receives batch updates at the end of a business day and isn't then used until 9 a.m. the next morning. Consider something such as a web blog, which has multiple web server nodes. No one's going to complain if, for example, the latest /.article isn't up 30 seconds from some other web server in the farm. So it does actually suit these kind of applications, but mostly it's used for failover. The biggest problem, this is the other big problem with it, it's more or less written in Java. I have a strong feeling that an outsourcing company in India was involved, but and hence the reason why it's written in Java. But I haven't actually run it myself because it's written in Java, and I see that point. But that doesn't mean that the good people at Astilius, for example, who have a much more significant business than mine and bring in, you know, $50 million a year in registrations and use this, don't have a problem with it. So it's just horses for courses, basically. Even though I am not using it myself, I strongly recommend people to check it out because it has been commercially tested, commercially used, and it is a viable replication, hot backup, replication facility for Postgres. I think we should probably, I'll just take a few questions and continue the talk after we come back. I think I'll say right now, anyone interested in replication, come to the boss. Were there any other questions? I'll be detailing that in a second. Okay.